Today is Thursday. It's September 13th, 2018. It's 11:18 in the morning. This is John Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast. We record at the studios at WGN Radio. Listen to my show weekdays from 1 to 3 and Saturdays 10 a.m. until 12 noon on WGN.
And I'm Justin Kaufman. I'm with the Steve Cochran Show, 6 to 10 a.m. here on WGN.
I'm Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and creator of the comic strip Prickly City and co-host of the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN+.
I'm Eric Zorn, the tremendously big and tremendously wet columnist from the Tribune. I run three times a week.
That's disgusting.
No, it's just true.
The president called this hurricane really wet.
Tremendously wet.
Tremendously wet.
And it is going to put a lot of rain on a lot of people, so technically it was wet. You know, I've been playing the does it matter game ever since Trump became president, and his language about this is a distraction we don't need. It is predictable. It's not constructive. So you can have that conversation all you want, but I'm putting this one on the side of, you know, more lies and obfuscation, but it's Trump being Trump.
Well, it's the issue of him describing the hurricane in strange terms is not the, I mean, what the issue right now is what he's talking about, Puerto Rico, right? I mean,
yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, yes, I want to start with Chicago. I took the bait. Shame on me, Eric. I shouldn't comment.
Ignore me, John, or I'll hijack your podcast every week.
It is so true. I'm so easy that way. Let's start with this one. This week, I don't know if you guys noticed, the New Yorker told the story of the shooting death of Laquan McDonald, the teenager who in 2014 was walking down the middle of a Chicago street when Officer Jason Van Dyke shot him 16 times. Van Dyke is charged with murder, and the Alex Kotlowitz piece includes an interview with Southside Reverend Ira Acri. Acri believes that Van Dyke will not be convicted. He's going to walk, he said. At issue is the race of the jurors, too, with 10 of the 12 selected as we record this podcast. You will have, at a minimum, 5 whites, 3 Hispanics, 1 Asian American, and so far 1 African American on that jury.
Walk into a bar. That's anytime you see a list like that.
So it'll be sometime today, depending on when you're listening to this, but it'll be sometime today in which the defense will have to decide if they're going to go forward with a jury trial, or if they're going to ask for a bench trial.
Yeah, the judge this morning said that's probably too late for that.
Who's that?
Patty Vasquez.
Sorry about that.
Just joining us.
Hi, I'm sorry.
Patty,
it's the voice out of nowhere. Hi,
do the thing we do where you say, I'm Patty Vasquez, and then do the thing.
Hi, I'm Patty Vasquez. I host the Patty Vasquez Show with Andrew Darlos. Weeknights 7 to 11, unless the White Sox play, and then we're on after.
Ryan Burrow was on yesterday, and he talked about the idea that the prosecution and the defense has 7 strikes. Right, 7 strikes to decide or to say who they don't want on the jury.
Right.
5 have already been used by the defense, and they were all African Americans.
Yeah.
And there was not really much discussion. They're like, nope, we'll use our strike. And it plays to what kind of trial this is going to be.
Technically, you're not supposed to. You cannot strike a juror just based on their race. But if that
right.
black juror says something that you think is prejudicial, if they're a bad juror, then of course you can strike them.
And if there is an acquittal, there's no appeal of that decision. The Supreme Court has ruled on this. I think it's called the Bastin, is that right, rule, which is that you can't strike jurors for race. But if there's a conviction of an African-American defendant, say, and a bunch of African-American jurors were stricken from the jury, then there's an appeal, grounds for an appeal. But in this case, the reason that we're concerned about this, although why people are looking at it very carefully, is that if there ends up being one African-American on a jury in a county that's 25% African-American, is that we looked that up
before
we started rolling here, and he's acquitted, there's no appeal to that decision, but there is going to be even more outrage on the streets if that happens. If the trial is not perceived as fair, then it's going to be a real problem.
Well, if you only have one black juror, good grief. I mean, it would be in everybody's interest.
Well, don't kid yourself about the defense. The defense would rather have an all-white jury.
I think the only thing that maybe goes the way of the prosecution is that this has been played, the video has been played over and over again. Unfortunately, sort of public opinion has been shaped for quite a while. You know, and you also have the protesters as the jurors go in every day seeing that, which is also problematic, I think, to have protesters outside the courthouse, you know, when the jurors are like, can we just be anonymous? Which
and, is neutral,
strange,
and
neutral,
and not
right.
influenced. Eric's talked about and written about that, wrote about that again since we last met, and said that makes justice difficult to.
Well, I think
I think Justin's point is well taken, though. I mean, the fact that this is just emblematic. This is illustrative of exactly what kind of trial we're going to have, right. And it's not going to be pretty. I can't think of a trial. I mean, the Blagojevich trial was obviously very important, the Ryan trial, but this trial has a bigger feel to it. It has much more national implications. I just feel like this may be the trial of the century in Chicago. You know. Do you think it was more important? I don't. I think this is the most important trial.
Well, just the NFL games alone with people protesting police abuse. I mean, this is exactly what people are talking about. Is saying that this, you know, there's times when police officers cross the line. We've talked about, are there bad apples, and is this something that is sort of symbolic of what's going on nationally that a lot of people in the black community feel is
what they've already laid the ground for in the defense is an appeal. I mean, they're every moment that they have, whether it's jury questionnaires, whether it's trying to move the trial somewhere else, whatever it might be, they are filing motions for an appeal. And if they do that, I mean, I just think about the fact that there is going to be a verdict in this trial, hopefully. And if there's not, and if there is, and it doesn't go to defense's way, it is going to be appeal, 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 appeal. Not unlike what we've seen with Blagojevich. But this is we're talking earlier, like, this is a pretty intense 3 weeks. It's going to be an intense couple years. they're going to appeal unless he gets acquitted. And even if he gets acquitted, I think there's going to be obvious repercussions for that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone around the table has a law degree, but I don't think right now that they've established grounds for appeal. I think that the venue, Cook County, they certainly have, in their questioning of jurors, have found people who haven't made up their minds. The judge seems to be a real stickler for a lot of things.
They're going to say right away that the jurors could not be partial because they were worried that if they acquitted this person, there would be violence in the streets of Chicago. And they have put that in, and they've even put that in writing.
Gosh, where would they get that?
You know, but that's the idea, that they're already setting that up for an argument if they need to argue after the verdict.
I just don't think that's going to be successful. I just can't imagine an appellate judge going, yeah, you know, people were worried about that, so that's why they voted.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean Justin's wrong. I mean, don't you think they'll be held to pay if Jason Van Dyke walks in this case?
Do I think so? Oh, yeah, I think there will be. I think there will be significant demonstrations and protests.
And are you guys
absolutely
concerned, though, about the number of African Americans on this jury? Mm-hmm. None of us are black, but I'll tell you what, I've come to believe in my old age that I do not see it through their eyes. And when this stuff comes up, black staff members, black callers will call in on the show, and they'll go, you don't get it.
Just be representative of the city and the county that we live in. If it's not going to be representative, then automatically mm-hmm. you've opened yourself up to...
Regardless of the case, even.
Yeah.
How interesting will it be if a predominantly white or a jury that lacks African-American representation does find him guilty? That'll be interesting as well.
And yeah, well, I think that will be good.
if that's what the evidence shows.
But you know, it's also not fair is Van Dyke going up as the bad cop for all of the crimes in the past, even if maybe there isn't sufficient evidence, if there was reason for him to shoot, right? But now, since we're so tired of this, you're the one that we're going to convict. And that's not unfair. Fair to him, right? Either. Although, you look at that video.
Yeah. I've heard from a number of people after I wrote my column last weekend talking about how I think that these protests are inappropriate outside the courthouse. I heard from a number of people talking about the symbolic significance of this case and how this has happened so many times, and Patty just alluded to that, how this is part of this larger moment. And our justice system is not supposed to work that way. Jason Van Dyke is not supposed to stand for all the racist cops who've shot people in situations where they shouldn't have shot them. He's not supposed to stand for all the cops who got away with shootings that we now think are fairly dubious. He is supposed to stand on what he did in those 6 seconds between the time he got out of his car and the time he emptied his weapon into Laquan McDonald. That is the moment we have to focus on here in the justice system. The justice system can't say, well, Laquan McDonald stands for these people, right, and Jason Van Dyke stands for these, and so we're going to make a decision which people we tend to side with.
That's happening.
It's happening. It's totally happening, and I understand why it's happening, and you know, I think I don't understand it, as your African-American callers will say. I don't understand it the way they do. But you can't use the justice system for that. Jason Van Dyke is guilty or not guilty, depending on what he did in those moments.
No.
Depending on what other cops have done.
I'm going to interrupt you right there, because that's where we're having a big problem and all these other orbiting issues. But at the core of this, the jux of this, he is not guilty. As of right now, he is not guilty. Black, white, Hispanic, male, female, any of that.
Presumed.
You are presumed innocent until you are found guilty. So as of today, Jason Van Dyke is innocent.
I don't think anybody being honest doesn't have a prejudiced view of this case. And I mean, Patty, have you seen the video?
It was interesting because the day that the tape came out, I actually am friends with quite a few police officers, and they were like, well, you know, then don't be on crack or whatever it was. And I thought, well, how did Van Dyke know that he was on crack or whatever? It was such a strange thing. And good cops, right? But they have their view of what they see every day or what they encounter, guys who work on SWAT and work in neighborhoods that most of us are afraid to drive through. But, you know, when I saw the video, I was like, he's walking away. And it looked like Van Dyke came out of the car shooting. The door opens and the gun is up. So I don't know. But I don't know how you see that differently.
I feel like as somebody who has grown up in this age now where videos like this are released and we're able to watch it on our phones and in our homes, there's context. And I'm not saying that we haven't seen what happened, you know, or not know what happened 20 minutes before that or 30 minutes before that. But I can understand a policeman's argument to say, what you see at the end of that video may not be the entire story.
Yeah, well, good luck to them on that. I mean, so if just out of frame, there's a potential victim and Laquan is about to harm that victim, you got something. But I mean, none of these scenarios that I can imagine existed in that case. His previous behavior might have been an issue that night, or in his life, which Van Dyke didn't even know about. But, you know, imagine a scenario. Can you guys, that justifies what you saw in that short clip? I mean,
the only thing I think about, and I'm trying to be as balanced as possible, is that the training of police officers when they use their firearm. If they are in a situation where this is not premeditated, this is what they feel in the moment, that this is their judgment call in a life or death situation, and that can be argued, and all that's going to be argued in court, that he unloaded his gun as trained to do. If he falls out of protocol, meaning he's not doing what he was trained to do, then there are wide open interpretations of what to do about that. But my point being that I could see the argument saying if he followed all of what he was supposed to do, and they tell you, and I've heard this in the last whatever, how many years now, 4 years, five, whatever,
almost
waiting
four,
on this trial,
fall.
We've heard police officers and people say that he followed the customary idea of, they say, if you're going to use your gun, use your gun.
Yeah, once you pull your deadly weapon.
You don't
weapon.
Shoot to wound.
So right. I understand that. I mean, I get that. I'm trying to be balanced. I mean, obviously, what you see on the video, of course, is startling and stunning and really horrifying. Mm. So you understand it. But if I would say that maybe police training might be on trial in the sense that that's not the way to go about that. But did that officer go out of what he was trained to do?
Right.
And
you
may not want to go into the deep weeds as like this, but if you look at the video, but if you also listen to the audio, the cops on the site before Van Dyke shows up were doing exactly what they should have done. They were de-escalating the situation. The guy was obviously stoned or drunk on something. He's staggering. So they cordoned him off. He made sure he wasn't a danger to anyone. Waiting for a moment where they could have arrested him. They were doing the right thing.
There's a great video that hasn't been seen much, which is of Laquan McDonald a couple minutes before the shooting. And it's a surveillance video, and it shows him walking down the sidewalk in that neighborhood. And a police car is like sort of right behind him in the street, just kind of following him along. And they clearly had the situation under control. They did not consider him an urgent or immediate threat. They were just monitoring him. You watch and you think, if that's what police are supposed to do in this situation, they were calling for a taser, and then he is as these other cars pull up. I don't know what Van Dyke knew when he heard on the radio, but he gets out, and McDonald is he's got a 3-inch knife, which is a little, it's about the size, you can buy a 3-inch Swiss Army knife. Mm-hmm. It's not like a machete or anything. He's got it at his side, away from the side of the officers, and he's walking at an angle away from them. And Van Dyke gets out, and in 6 seconds, he unloads his gun into him and spins him around and puts him on the ground and keeps firing. And the other officers on the scene are saying, well, he was trying to get up, and he was advancing, or he was waving his knife.
And the spokesperson for the Fraternal Order of Police at that moment said he was lunging at him,
case
closed.
They're all lies. They're all lies. They all got together, and they cooked up these horrible lies, which tells you, and why did they lie if this wasn't a gross violation of their training and of what was supposed to happen? They knew that this was really bad. And then a couple days later, the brass saw it. McCarthy saw it. Eddie Johnson saw it. All these people saw this video, and they didn't do anything about it.
Did Rahm see it, do you think? Do you think that's why he's not running?
Well, we can get into that next.
Okay.
Well, I don't know when he saw it. I don't remember when he saw it. He had to have seen before they approved this $5 million settlement. You'd think, for God's sake, that the mayor would have looked at it and the council would have looked at it. So
everything's wrong about that story. By the way, I just want to read one paragraph from the Chicago Tribune today, Thursday, and then we'll move on. One of the women jurors, in fact, the black juror so far, the woman who works as a FedEx driver and appears to be in her 50s, said she had seen the police dashboard camera video that captured Van Dyke shooting 17-year-old McDonald 16 times. During questioning Wednesday, that woman said that she could not say that Van Dyke was guilty, but I had an opinion about how many times the shots went off, she said. I can't lie about that. That's a lot of shots. And I've wondered that, too. If he had shot once or twice, you know, dropped him, maybe there's a chance to save him, but at least you've remedied the potential threat. Really, it is the other 14 shots.
It's 16 shots. It makes it
extraordinary.
Yeah, it really makes it, it's just a really difficult story to defend.
Different subject in the city of Chicago. Patty, you just inhaled.
I know.
Congratulations on that.
Well, to that, though, I didn't realize that Jason Van Dyke actually had accrued quite a few complaints from civilians and put him in the top 3% of police officers with complaints. So, you know, his previous behavior and what led to that moment is also going to be important.
It's a funny statistic, though, but it's a weird one, because he'd also had a lot of commendations, and the guys who are going to get the most complaints are the guys working in the tough neighborhoods, right? So if you're working in a nice neighborhood, you're not going to have as many altercations. There are going to be fewer complaints against you. He'd never used this weapon before. Was he a bad cop, quote unquote? I don't know, Patty. Those numbers are compelling. But I think they are complicated,
they did,
too.
The study that was referred to on Channel 11 last night, they had a segment on the study about bad cops, and they put Van Dyke into that spectrum, is they tried to adjust for the neighborhood. Because obviously, if you're in a tough neighborhood, you're going to have a lot harder interactions with police than you do if you're in, say, in my neighborhood, which is, you know, the fanciest neighborhood in Chicago.
Right? Here's a new subject. Have you taken a side on the hotel workers' strike in Chicago? 26 hotels now. A lot of the big hotels downtown, the Palmer House, the Sheraton, the Hilton. Somebody else is making your bed. The workers want health coverage in the winter when a lot of them are laid off and they lose their health coverage. I'm sympathetic to that. If my hotel room went from $487 a night to, you know, $492 a night, I'm willing to chip in and help the hotels cover the cost.
How much? Where do you stay?
I'm making that number up.
That's probably what a Chicago hotel
is. He stays in my neighborhood.
Like.
Actually, a friend of mine stayed in town this week, and a room in a not swank hotel, he was quoted, was $502 a night.
Yeah, they're jacking 502.
Up. Now, that may be because rooms are harder to come by right now. In fact, that same hotel at other nights was 100 and something a night.
Wow.
Yes, and January is a good time for that.
It is. It's
really?
Yeah. Oh, we just do like a staycation, come into the city and stay somewhere?
It's great, right on Michigan Avenue.
Okay, but if whatever the cost is, you and I have to defray that cost for the hotel, I'm in. I feel bad for hotel workers. Every time I'm checking in or out of a room and there's somebody pushing a cart down the aisle or doing any hotel work, I think that looks so miserable. And I know they're not getting paid a lot. I'm willing to pay those people more. One of the hotel workers was in our studio yesterday, and she said, so if you're on diabetes, or if you're a diabetic, or if you have any other chronic condition, you need to budget your care because you can't afford it, or you can't afford to eat because you're going to afford your health care for 3-4 months a year. And you can't break your arm in January because you don't have health coverage.
I think
then that
this is a great story. Obviously, it's a labor story. But it also uncovers how big business does their job or their business in the way that, you know, to have seasonal employees in this kind of environment where all we hear about hotels and hotels and hotels is money, money, money. They're making money, money, money. And as a consumer, as tourism is up, and that means the price of the hotel room goes up. But to know that that's how the hotels are it's new to me. Like, it's not something I've paid attention to as to how they're dealing with people who are service employees for the hotel, that they lay them off in slow times.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
Never thought about it. So it is good that I give the union props in that regard, that I don't think that that's right. I don't think that, I think that that's another way that it's like unemployment's down and up, and they're playing little numbers and deciding to go with part-time work as opposed to full-time work. And I think that the job seems to be a tough job, and it seems to be one that should get benefits to, because these people are working hard.
Well, I think everybody should have health care all the time, whether they're working at a hotel or not working at all. And I think that we should go to a Medicare for all system, and I'm radical in that way. So I'm totally sympathetic with this idea that they deserve and get health care. I don't know about the wage issues and the other things that they're complaining about, but that seems to me to be just basic. If you've got someone who works for you, what is it, 9 months a year, and there's 3 months a year they're off, come on.
Well, and when I travel a lot, what I value my hotel is based on the location and how clean the rooms are, the status of the rooms, and that's going to be entirely dependent on how good the crew is. So, you know, pay them what they're worth, and that it's, for me, it's half of where I'm staying. Is how nice the room is.
Did that hotel worker tell you that the reason they do the seasonal type 9 months instead of 12 is because so they don't have to pay the health care? Are hotel corporations finding a loophole in the system to be like, if I don't pay them this much at this time, then I don't have to pay for health care?
She didn't put it that way. She just said the demand is less. They need fewer people. So that's the quandary for the management. I mean, maybe you shouldn't pay a worker 40 hours if you don't need them, but for 20 or 10, but I would find a way to extend that.
I could see the argument of saying we don't need you for 12 months, so we're going to pay you for 9 months, and you can work 9 months, and the other 3 months you can go get another job, whatever. But I would think that that person needs to be covered by health care. This person who has diabetes or talks about this, yeah. I mean, that's perfectly reasonable. Like, what are they supposed to do? It's really expensive.
Yeah, that's the issue we're addressing here, and that's the, you know, we live in a country where there's not affordable health care, let alone, you know, Medicaid for all.
And this is the conservative on the panel speaking, ladies and gentlemen.
No, it is. It is. I think that it's a gin system. I think it hurts an awful lot of people. It kills people, quite frankly, and it needs to be addressed in a serious manner.
Made up numbers.
High five across the table.
Let me throw a number at you that I looked up this week. When you buy a gallon of gas, how much of that is tax? It's not a percentage. It's a set amount. What on a gallon of gas do you pay in Illinois Chicago for a gallon? How much of it is
taxed? I told there would be a quiz.
It's like half, isn't it?
37 cents.
I was going to say 30 cents. Oh, man.
You should have said it. You should have said it.
That
sounds like a lot to me. So if you fill up, you've just paid $7 in taxes. Think about that. That's a lot. Okay, so a notion has been afoot for a while that, you know, who's not paying the $7 in taxes? People that are driving electric cars. Mm-hmm. Or people that are driving hybrid cars and are paying less because they're buying less gas. And if a road is a shared expense for all of us and it's funded in part by fuel taxes, the people who are skating now are those people driving those fancy Teslas. One way to fix that is to tax you per miles driven.
Used hybrid, by the way. I'm not driving a Tesla, but I do fill up on a lot less.
Yeah,
it takes
kidding.
Me 26 bucks to fill up. It's great.
Isn't it wonderful? And
about
you go
two
a
weeks.
Week that way.
Oh, two weeks, baby.
And yet there you are zipping around on the road as much as somebody else is, mm-hmm. and you're not paying your fair share. And the Tesla driver isn't paying at all. So there's a Rauner ad right now that accuses JB of wanting to tax you for every mile you drive.
Uh-oh.
With a government monitor that will know where you're going to.
Dun, dun, dun.
And there's a woman going, I don't think I can. So if I go to visit my mom, I'll have to pay a tax. I don't think I can live in Illinois anymore.
The thing is, I mean, I understand not wanting to be followed by a GPS monitor, but that the government is looking at. It's one way to do it. There's also ways to do it where you could just keep track of the miles driven. Problem figuring out, well, okay, I mean, like, I drive back to Michigan a lot to see my folks. I don't know, you know, if they're going to charge me for those miles drive in Michigan.
Illinois miles, right.
I don't know. I mean, it does seem fair to me. The gas tax is low. It's been really low for a long time. It's not keeping up with the demand for road services. That's where our infrastructure is crumbling in part. This woman is right now, when she goes to visit her mother, she's paying taxes because she's paying fuel taxes. Presumably, if you were to do a mileage tax, you would
take that away.
To reduce the fuel tax
or
to make up for it.
Yeah.
And it is fair. I certainly understand what Pritzker is saying. It is fair to tax people on the amount they use our roads.
Well, JB was asked at an editorial board meeting, what do you think about this? He goes, you know, that's worth study. Okay, but now Rauner is accusing him.
Isn't that the problem, though, at the end of the day with the way campaigns are run right now, and it's this campaign in particular, that every time one of these candidates decides to get into the actual issues that are in front of us, the other is waiting with bated breath and a packet or a pocket full of cash to put an attack ad out.
Yeah, and that is misleading. I mean, I know I sound naive there, but I hate commercials that lie to me.
Well, especially
I hate that.
Sorry.
No,
but especially Rauner's during the primary when he accused Jeannie Ives of being a Madigan toady. It's like,
yeah, that was absurd.
What?
Yeah.
it keeps any candidate for actually talking about what might be an interesting idea or, you know what, I study that or coming up with what if we did this? I mean, I feel like that's a trouble spot for our democracy because I have heard nonstop campaign messages, not issues, campaign messages from both of these guys. And I'm not feeling as a voter that I am well prepared to decide who's going to be the next voter of Illinois or the next governor of Illinois, because I feel like all I'm getting is, you know, Pritzker's going to raise your taxes.
Well,
and Rauner's a failure.
I really want Pritzker to come out and explain how he wants the graduated income tax to work. He wants to institute a progressive income tax in Illinois. I think that's a fair conversation to have. There's a progressive income tax in more than half the states right now.
And the federal government.
It's not a radical proposal. It's not a radical idea. It doesn't necessarily raise taxes on middle-income people. Pritzker won't go there. All he says is, I want people like me and Bruce Rauner to pay more taxes.
I'm okay with that, but I make some money, so where's the threshold on this?
Exactly. You want to know what he wants.
I want to be just below whatever that line is.
He's sitting on his lead in the polls, but we cannot have a substantive discussion if no one's going to give us any substance.
Yeah.
Good point. Violence in Chicago should be an issue. I think schools, and I would think Rauner, and he's got a big policy speech today at 2 o'clock. I think you'd zero in on the fact that he gave schools more money in the state of Illinois.
Not willingly.
Yeah, maybe not willingly. But Rahm Emanuel goes around.
That was a pretty long battle.
Point Pat.
Emanuel wants it to be part of his legacy. I just feel like he doesn't talk about any of that stuff, and it just kind of drives me crazy.
He vetoed the money, the spending bill for education.
Yeah,
the only reason he gave it is because that was overridden by the legislature.
At least it happened under his watch.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's how politicians take credit for stuff, right?
I want to segue to another threat to democracy in Trump land.
It's like there's a horse loose in a hospital. Like, I think everything's going to be okay, but I have no idea what's going to happen next.
The response to Maria in Puerto Rico was better than Texas. It was better than Florida.
I think in a certain way, the best job we did was Puerto Rico, but nobody would understand that. I mean, it's harder to understand. It was a very hard, very hard thing to do.
3,000 people did not die in those two hurricanes in Puerto Rico, the president tweeted. He wrote, when I left the island... After the storm had hit, they had anywhere from 6 to 18 deaths. As time went by, it did not go up much. Then, a long time later, they started to report really large numbers, like 3,000. This was done by the Democrats in order to make me look as bad as possible when I was successfully raising capital B billions of capital D dollars to help rebuild Puerto Rico. If a person died for any reason, like old age, just add them onto the list. Bad politics. I love Puerto Rico.
I feel like a strange move, strategy move to question death tolls.
Well, in a study that was done by an independent institution, and Paul Ryan has come out and said there's no reason to doubt this study.
FEMA does not doubt this study. FEMA said their response was inadequate. I mean, think about that. You know, the president has his view of reality, but I think FEMA is a pretty credible voice in this, since they're the ones charged with doing it, and they said that their response was inadequate.
Well, and listen to the language he uses, even describing the deaths that he acknowledges. It's still just like, yeah, some people died, you know.
Throw them on the heap.
Whatever, yeah. It's a small pile of brown people. It's okay.
Okay, so but you know where the number comes from. It's... In the 6 months afterwards, how many people historically have died versus how many did, and the number's a few thousand higher.
Right, which is why that old age thing is ridiculous. And you got to remember that after...
Is relevant.
Well, he says people die of old age, and they add their numbers to the... What this studies do is they look at the typical
a number of deaths that you would expect, and then they look at the number that they actually got. And that's the difference there. The delta is where you talk about what the effects of the hurricane
are. Sure, but some of those are older, frail people who under normal circumstances might have yet been able to live, but because they're older, frail, didn't get enough water, didn't get enough cooling.
Could you imagine if Mayor Daley, I mean, if there's Twitter around at the time, but if Mayor Daley after the heat wave in Chicago and 500 people died, he's like, yeah, a lot of those people were old and went off
they're
on trying to make
die
a,
anyway.
Yeah, making a political statement.
Probably
out of it.
Dead it's, by now.
And,
so.
And I think about George W. Bush and Katrina in the same way that imagine if that president spent time politically fighting about it. I don't understand.
Right, going on an attack that isn't the battle he needs to be fighting. There's so many different things to be concerned
with.
And
it's tone deaf on the, here comes a hurricane. Yeah. And this is what you're talking about? Is that...
Don't worry, we got you covered. In fact, we did such a good job in Puerto Rico. That should give the people in the Carolinas comfort, right, in advance?
Externally wet and externally windy.
Tremendously big and tremendously wet.
But don't you think...
Just like me.
Besides, if the president had said, we underperformed... I don't even think that's a complete indictment of Donald Trump. That is, it's a bureaucracy. The buck stops there, but it's not like he didn't take his turn filling sandbags.
I thought that's what we hired him for. The idea that he's coming in is he's the apprentice. He's the CEO, comes in and goes, you didn't do a good enough job, Scott, you're fired. You know, or whatever it is a terrible Trump. But the point
being,
like,
I haven't heard that before.
I thought that's what he did. If someone did an inadequate job at the government, he was going to hold them accountable. But instead, what we see is he takes it personal.
Speaking of the swamp, has anyone been following the coverage of the hog farms in North Carolina?
Oh, this is going to be in the water.
Where the hog farms are just not equipped for more than, like, 12 or 20 inches of rain, something like that, and we're expecting 40 inches of rain. But in any case, you're just going to have this, you know, hog waste and dead hogs floating all over North Carolina if this storm turns out to be what it's going to look
like. Have any of you lived through a hurricane or lived someplace? I lived in Birmingham, Alabama for a number of years, and so one Ivan just came up so fast it actually hit us with hurricane-level winds. Honest to God, for anyone who listens to this podcast in North or South Carolina, get the hell out of there now because it is dangerous. It's horrible. You're not going to, even if you make it through the storm, you're not going to have electricity for weeks.
I love Chicago.
Yeah, I know.
No earthquakes.
We've had this conversation. This is a city not without its problems. We've been talking about them, but we don't have many tornadoes. We have no hurricanes.
No earthquakes.
We do not have 120 degrees, which they get in the Southwest. We don't have California fires.
We have killer bees.
I know. Our weather ain't perfect. We have four vigorous seasons.
We just have West Nile.
Because the idea
well,
of
that. Thank you, Scott. Good one. Justin.
The idea of evacuating, I was listening to Ryan Burroughs talk to Bill and Wendy, and they were talking about how if you don't have enough money, I mean, there aren't people that can just pick up and go, have anywhere to stay or have a car. So the people who are ill or poor are going to be left behind, and there are people who can spend weeks in a hotel.
And I appreciate that Scott has lived in, you know, a hurricane. I've heard a lot of people who have come up and say, this is what you have to do to people who live in coastal areas. I don't know that culture. I know they have respect for water. They live on the ocean. They understand where they're at in the world and what they do. So if they don't have the resources and they don't have, if they're living in poverty and they know where they're living, I feel a little skirmish to be the guy that's like, you should do this. Like, who am I to tell them what to do?
If you can't get out, I guess.
Help those
who can't.
I think there's a lot of people, though, that want to stay. I mean, if you told me I was going to survive, I would get in a car and drive down there. I would love to see what the full force of Mother Nature is like. If I knew I was going to...
Watch CNN.
I got a Facebook Live video for you right here. Let's just go ahead and watch it.
You know, I've been watching video this morning of camera on Kitty Hawk and the Outer Banks, and it's amazing what's already cooking up out
there. Oh, no.
It's time for our recommendations, unless there's something you guys want to throw into the mix. Erica, did we miss a topic that you love today?
I just wanted to talk a little bit about the candidates and the mayor's race real quickly and note how odd it was that Luis Gutierrez came out yesterday and basically is trying to publicly draft Chuy García. And I just want to point out that Chuy García was not a very good candidate last time. He was not prepared. He was unimpressive one-on-one against Emmanuel. Maybe 4 years has seasoned him. We'll see. But I'm not sure why all this enthusiasm for Chuy García.
And I always drew a García as just a mustache because there is so little substance
there.
That's all you got.
And for substance, if you want a candidate with substance and who's Hispanic, I like Susana Mendoza.
Well, what about the theory that was thrown out to back Tony Preckwinkle or to at least scare off Susana Mendoza?
I saw that. I don't know. I
mean, well, since this is the podcast that accurately predicted that Donald Trump would not win the Republican primary, I think we should each week say, where are we on who's going to win the next mayor's race in Chicago? Justin, you go first.
I, It's mayor. It's Cook County Board President Toni Preckwinkle's to choose.
Yeah.
I really do. I think that if she chooses, she wants to get in, she wins.
And by the way, you do have the option of answering with the winning candidate has not yet announced. But, Scotty, who do you like,
John? You do not have that option. I say you have to pick somebody. Come on, John.
Really?
Okay. Name somebody.
Okay,
just
but
name somebody.
All right, but then I could do Valerie Jarrett, even though she hasn't announced.
You can go ahead and do that.
Fine, then Valerie
Humiliate
Jarrett.
Humiliate yourself.
You lose to Toni Preckwinkle.
I already picked Trump's not going to win the Republican nomination, so I'm already there. Go.
I'm agreeing with Justin far too much this podcast, but I agree. With him again, I think it's going to be it's Tony's to lose. It's
if
hers.
She wants it, yeah.
Oh, I don't see that at all. But I do like Lori Lightfoot. I have to agree with Eric that I think Susana Mendoza makes it a really interesting race.
Yeah. So where are you, Mr. Zorn?
Well, if I had to put a coin down on one of the candidates, it would be on Preckwinkle right now.
Wow, you guys all think Preckwinkle?
No, I'm surprised that you guys.
She's won in the district.
No. She's not charismatic.
Twice. She's got executive
the soda
experience.
Tax hanging around.
She's
her.
An alderman. She's got past the soda tax. She's also the head of the Cook County Democrats? I don't understand. I mean, it's a no-brainer. She covers almost all of the areas that you would want a checklist if you were looking for a mayor or a candidate.
We got to get out of the studio in 3 minutes. Eric Zorn's recommendation this week is...
I'm on the Twitter account Chicago Party Ant, Shy Party Ant, I was researching this before I came over here, and the character is Time Out Chicago describes her as the trashiest, drunkest, suburbiest, Chicagolandiest woman of all time. She loves Jewel Osco's baked potato soup, wears obscene Cubs gear, and seeks legal counsel from Peter Francis DeRacy.
She's running for mayor.
And she's running for mayor, which is why her Twitter account has blown up. Justin knows the comedian behind the account. And I was telling Justin that this character reminds me of Colleen Henneman, who is the character that is played by actress Kate James. And Justin has interviewed her many times because they're in the same comedy troupes.
Yes.
My recommendation is to pay cash. It'll cost you $30. Fear Trump in the White House by Bob Woodward. I'm finding it fascinating and surprisingly funny.
I'll say I'm going to see Weezer tonight at Riot Fest.
Nice. Yeah.
I just finished season 2 of Ozark, and it was incredible, and Laura Linney should win whatever awards are given.
She's really good,
like,
but you didn't feel it fell apart in the last few episodes?
Oh, my God,
I'm not there yet.
No, because it got pulled together all in the last few moments.
Crazy.
Oh, man, yes.
Wow. This is a whole separate podcast, because last week, John basically trashed the second season.
I just finished it two nights ago.
I am going with Amazon's Prime's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The show starts in 1958.
Mm-hmm. That she would hang out with Lenny Bruce.
Well, they got to be friends.
It's sweet. It's a sweet show that she would take off her clothes on stage. And you know, there's, but I'm sorry. It's not supposed to be make fun of somebody else's pick. Go ahead.
Yes. And Rachel Brosnahan is terrific in the title character. And the woman who plays her manager is Alyssa McGuigan. I believe that it is. And Tony Shalhoub is in it as well. It looks good. It's written okay. Like I said, there are some flaws in the plot, some holes. But for the most part, it's a delightful show to watch.
Thank you, Scott Stanis. Patty, nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Justin, too. Thanks for coming in. Yep. You guys aren't always in the studio. We love it when you are. Eric Zorn is, too. Thank you, producer Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.